Sybil is the very great expert on Etruscan material and visual culture. She's the world expert on Etruscan bronzes, and summed up a lifetime's thought and research on the Etruscans in this magnificent volume issued in German and in English, Etruscan Civilization, A Cultural History. A true monument to scholarship. I love the title of Sybil's Festschrift, which sums her up so well. It's called Etruscan by Definition. We're very lucky in many respects to have Sybil settled up here among us with the other members of the German colonnade in Oxford, if I can call them that. Some wild figures who've been tamed by their Oxonian spouses. They, and especially Sybil, have become an important part of our Mediterranean archaeological life here, taking part in seminars, lectures, asking questions, and providing detailed knowledge where none is available amongst us. Sybil is now giving advanced Italic sessions to some of our best graduate students up on Banbury Road. These graduate students starved of real knowledge of this exciting area. I too have received one of these sessions, a basic one, not an advanced one, on recent discoveries in Etruria to prepare myself to interest and excite donors for another project that I'll talk about. Sybil has given us much, much more. She's set up a fund, the Sybil Haynes Fund for Etruscan and Italic Studies here in the university. And I know about it because I'm privileged to serve as a trustee of the fund. It's this fund which funds this annual lecture, and it's a fund which has a much wider ambition to fund a post a lectureship in this subject. Sybil has corralled some very impressive donors and put in a huge amount herself. She is one of our leading benefactresses in this area. This fund has now been put together with Somerville College, which has a burning need, some good resources, and a long tradition in Mediterranean archaeology. And we're deeply grateful to Somerville for pairing up with the Haynes Fund to create this lectureship, and it will be a very great home for it. We still have a little funding gap to get over, but we soon will have a university lectureship based at Somerville in Etruscan and Central Italian archaeology. My second job today is to introduce our distinguished speaker, Friedhelm Preon from the University of Tübingen. The department's in a wonderful place, I don't know if many of you have been there, perched in a medieval castle overlooking a beautiful valley below. You can't go very far in any serious Etruscan bibliography or any serious Etruscan topic without finding Friedhelm Preon's name a lot. He's that rare thing, a deep expert in both Anatolian archaeology and archaic Etruscan archaeology, two areas that are so deeply connected. He has a series of major articles and books, but all around the themes of monuments, architecture, houses, tombs of the early Etruscans and early Italians. It's not going too far to say, I think, that Professor Preon has really established Etruscology as a sub-discipline in Germany. Some of those monographs are on early Etruscan grave and house architecture, Phrygian sculpture, funerary beliefs and ancestor cults in Etruria, that one quite recent, and an excellent book in the Beck-Wissen series, now in its fifth edition, De Etrusca. He's run major field projects in Orvieto and Civitavecchia, and I think also in Cerveteri. Today we're very much looking forward to his lecture, as you can see on the screen, Tombs, Houses and Palaces in Archaic Etruria and Latium. Professor Preon.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I am well to be understood. like this? Okay. I feel very honored that I may talk to you within the series of Etruscan lectures in Oxford. Let me heartily thank Bert Smith for his very kind introduction and the Department of Classics as well as Somerville College for making these lectures possible. I'm grateful to the Bille-Haynes first for inviting me to come here. Secondly, for the institution just mentioned of this lecture series that will draw renewed attention to an important culture threatened with neglect, not only as far as the general public is concerned, but also from the part of the scholarly world, and very unjustly so. This was not always the case. In fact, Britain has been quite active in furthering the exploration and popularizing of Etruscan culture. The British interest in the Etruscans began in the first half of the 7th century with a publication in Italian of a description of Etruria, De Etruria Regali, by the Scotsman Thomas Dempster. It culminated in the second half of the 18th and the first half of the 19th century, when it even called for a special kind of ceramic production, the once famous manufacture called Etruria of Josiah Wedgwood, you see here, was this decorated with figures in a neoclassic style, inspired by the thousands of vases found in those years during excavations of chamber tombs in Etruria. It doesn't matter that these vases were of Greek production. They were considered Etruscan and excited interest in the culture. Travelers as John Byers and Mrs. Hamilton Gray, in her popular travel account, tour to the sepulchres in Etruria in 1839, further evoked the interest in this newly discovered, culture and instigated other people, among them George Dennis, to its study. It is indeed George Dennis who must be considered the first topographer of Etruria. Between 1842 and 1847, he explored all Etruria on horseback. And in 1848, he published his famous book, The Cities and Cemeteries of Etruria, a wonderful description of the land and its people, full of humorous annotations. But also, and for us, this is the most valuable part of his work, with a lot of observations and reflections about the archaeological remains he saw. One good example of his manner of looking at things is his description and interpretation of the house-like tomb of the Shields and Seals on the right in Cheveteri, which lies at the center of my contribution and is therefore very suitable as an introduction to our subject. In 1848, Dennis wrote as follows, providing also a grant plan, you see it on the left, and a section of the tomb. I cite him. Many of the tombs had a large central chamber with others of smaller size opening upon it, lighted by small windows in the wall of the rock, which served as the partition. This central chamber, here E in this plan from Dennis, represented the atrium of Etruscan houses, whence it was borrowed by the Romans. In the chambers around it, the triclinia, for each had a bench of rock round three of the sides, on which the dead had lain, reclining in effigy as a banquet. The ceilings of the chambers had the usual beams and rafters hewn in the rock, whence it may be inferred that such decorations were at one period fashionable in Etruscan houses. Dennis continues, but the marble of the tomb is an armchair cut from the living rock, standing by the side of one of the two sepulchral couches in the outer chamber, as though it were an easy chair by the bedside or as a seat for the doctor visiting his patient. But why placed in a tomb? Was it merely to carry out still further the analogy of to a house? Or was it, as Visconti suggests, for the use of the relatives who came yearly to hold solemn festivals at the tomb? Or was it for the shade of the deceased himself, as though he were too restless to be satisfied with his banqueting couch, but must have his easy chair also to repose him after his wanderings? Or, as Michali opines, was it to intimate the blissful repose of the new life on which his spirit had entered? Or was it rather a curule chair, the insignia of the rank or condition of the deceased, showing him to have been a ruler or magnate in the land? So Dennis in 1848. Before we try to answer the questions he put forth, another Englishman should be mentioned. That is Samuel James Ainslie, a contemporary of Dennis and his faithful companion during his expeditions. Ainslie was an excellent and precise draftsman, also filled with enthusiasm for the Etruscan monuments and therefore very well suited to supplement Dennis' descriptions. A fine example in our context is a tomb of the family of the Volumni near Perugia, you see here, with the original arrangement of the urns in the central chamber at the rear. Once again, Dennis described the tomb in great detail. He recognized the domestic character by the arrangement of the rooms with a mighty central hall imitating the atrium and a patrician of a patrician dwelling house. He also referred to the inscriptions telling us that the sepulchre first belonged to the Velimna family in the late Etruscan period and was still in use during the Roman period, when the family name had been Romanized to Volumnii. Such chamber tombs suggest the interior of dwelling houses developed mainly under the ideal geological conditions of southern Etruria, south of a line running roughly from Vulci to Perugia, like this, more or less. The landscape is to this day characterized by sedimentary volcanic material that lends itself easily to be chiseled into architectural shapes. Because of the soft tufa predominant in the surroundings of modern Cheviti, the main city also for our studies, conditions were particularly favorable there, and it is there that we find the greatest variety of elaborate tomb chambers, among them the tomb of the shield and seats, which you have already seen. Seen from outside, as on this aerial photo, the early tombs of Cheviti, this is only a very small part of the necropolis of Banditaccia, one of several in Cheviti. The early tombs of Cheviti do certainly not look like dwelling houses. Those tumuli actually resemble molehills, especially here. The earliest are spread all over the countryside. Later, they are arranged along the streets in the necropolis. Cheviti shows a distinct chronological development from unspectacular depressions in the 9th and 10th centuries BC. In the following discussion, I do not mention anymore BC. It's always we are in the period from 8th to 5th, 4th century BC. I only say the century. From unspectacular depressions in the 9th and 8th centuries BC, the so-called pozza or fossa graves, you see them here, for instance, very small ones. Two large tumuli in the 7th century with a diameter up to 50 meters. In the 6th century, new created tumuli tend to be smaller. From the late 6th century on, the round tumuli are succeeded by rectangular tombs, probably to save space. They form a regular frontage, a real necropolis that makes one think of a town of the dead. Here, the later ones. Later ones, that means 6th century, second half of 6th century. Archaic period. Besides the hollowed-out chamber tomb, there exists, especially in the early Etruscan period, the so-called Villanova culture of the 9th and 8th centuries, grave urns that are shaped like simple huts made of clay, mostly oval. Some example you have, for instance, here in the Ashmolean Museum. Sometimes rectangular, more or less, as this example. By its doors and windows, and above all by its hipped roof, the urn is, without any doubt, a stylized imitation of a dwelling house of the period. The urns containing the ashes of the dead would then mean that the deceased is buried in his proper dwelling house, a notion that, from the early 7th century on, becomes characteristic to the interior of the rock tombs on the right. The tomb of the hut, Tomba della Capanna, is a good example. Just as at a thatched cottage, the pitches of the roof are curved on either side, and the ridge is very narrow. The tomb, consisting of two rooms, features another speciality, a row of river pebbles. Originally, they were plain. This is a photo perhaps 10 years old. Today, you find any pebble anymore. It's all taken away. Followed the back wall of the inner room. The foundations of simple dwelling houses of the same period, for instance in San Giovanale, you see on the left side, also show such a layer of stones arranged in the same way. Here, and there are other examples. In the house, it served as insulation against the humidity arising from the ground. You find this technique also in modern houses, if you regard these pebble stones outside, also against humidity. The same matter. Covered with blankets, it was a sleeping place. The ground plan of the house is oval, with the entrance from the narrow side, just as the urns and the tomb chambers of the period. The interior of the house is structured by a kind of anteroom and by central posts. From the roof covering of the 9th and 8th century houses, there is nothing left at all, because they were thatched with such perishable material as straw. Here is it is the clay urns and the interior of the hollowed-out tomb chambers that allow a reconstruction as dwelling house with hipped roof. In Tarquinia, the town where beautiful figural frescoes are preserved in the tombs, another early Etruscan settlement has partially been excavated. Here we find the same oval house types, but also rectangular ones. House number 13. With a length of 15 meters, the biggest of all, is of special interest. The interior was structured by four posts. arranged in the same way we will find in the chamber tombs of the 7th century. I have already mentioned that the big tumuli, archaic tumuli in Cerveteri, contain several tombs. These tumuli are those of the elite. The individual graves in the tumulus are not contemporary, but extend over several generations. Difference it by colors also. The earliest 7th century graves, here shown in brown, they are all brown.
Oh.
No, one day.
That's strange. For me, they are all equal. I speak about
it's all right.
Those brown.
Yes.
And the other should have another color.
Okay. The earliest 7th century graves, here shown in brown, are situated in the northwest sector of the tumulus, and they look towards the northwest, this direction. Namely, in the direction of the Etruscan underworld. We should imagine the soul of the deceased to pass through the arched gate from the inside out, and the corridor called Dromos, into the underworld, so that the Dromos may here rather be regarded as an exit for the soul. Those 7th century graves do not all show the same structure or interior decoration. At the end of the long Dromos in tumulus number 1, from around 700 BC, there is a small chamber of the hut type with narrow ridge and rafter sloping in a curve similar to the tomb of the hut that I have shown before. The somewhat later tombs of tumuli number 2, 3, and 4, also marked in brown, are larger and have side chambers at the end of the dromos. The main chamber does not imitate a hut, or a house in the character of a hut, but a solid house. The narrow ridge, you see examples on the right side. The narrow ridge is substituted by a broader beam. The interior is structured by pillars or pilasters, in this case, and pillars. Here are two. Normally there are four, and I remember you the hut we saw before with four, the same structure. The main chamber does not imitate a hut or a simple constructed house, but a very solid one. The narrow ridge is substituted. I also always did said. And in the walls on the top of which rests an entablature with a structure supporting the ridge. The ensemble imitates a solid arch room or house divided into three parts. The beds are chiseled out of the tuff in their original size. In the earlier period, they were transported real beds inside the tomb. Now they are chiseled out. The outside feature of the dwelling houses must have been more solid and more monumental than the hut-like houses of the previous period. And the hipped roof from the mid-7th century on was covered by massive roof tiles, a revolutionary building technique, probably imported from Greece at that time. It is the same technique that exists uninterruptedly in modern Europe. From the mid of the 7th century till now, we have the same tiles, more or less. A drawing taken from a comic book can at least give an idea of what such a one-room house may have looked like. Furniture and clothing are copied from Etruscan monuments, but the high pointed heads of the men belong to the custom of priests, and the curved staff. Ah, this attitude is interested later on, as you know. certainly not carried at home. But the colorful painting of the walls especially with animals in an orientalizing style, is characteristic of especially and only of the early graves in Cervetri, the big one of the 7th century, and may therefore also be supposed to decorate the walls of the early Etruscan dwelling house. From the early 6th century, a new type of house develops in Etruria. We have seen its imitation at the beginning of my talk when I showed you the tomb of the Chiles and the seats. You see the plan again. In Acquarossa, a small Etruscan settlement in the hinterland of Viterbo, detached houses with several rooms are grouped around a well in a courtyard. Just as it appears in the central part of the tomb, this house type has rooms lying side by side behind a narrow connecting room, either a closed anteroom or an open portico. You see here, and here, and also there. Important for the history of the development is a house type, also known from Rome, which has three rooms lying behind the portico. The functions of the various rooms in the dwelling house is still uncertain, whereas in the tomb, the central room is the most important one. It is larger than the side rooms and contains the main burial, that of the donor and his wife. The two seats in the broad room refer to that very couple who in Republican Rome were called pater and mater familias. The typological mediation between broad house and atrium is provided by a grave so far standing alone, again in Cervetri, the Tomba della Ripa, or Tomb of the Tablinum, from the mid-6th century. Here the central room and the broad room form a unity. The connecting door is enlarged. A false door in the back room suggests an exit. In 1955 already, the excavator, Roberto Vigi, realized the typological relation to the Roman atrium house. The atrium is a core, the tablinum, this room, atrium, tablinum, opens towards the center, and in the access at the end of the tablinum is the access to the garden, a layout that corresponds to that of the older phase of the house of the Serge in Pompeii, this one. The first phase, this first phase of the house is dated to the 4th century, that is 2 centuries later than the Tomba del Tablino, Tomb of the Tablinum, in Cervetri. Early forms or predecessors of the atrium house existed in Etruria in the 6th century already. That has in fact been proven by a relatively new finding in Roselle, north of Grosseto. At the edge of the ancient settlement, a house was excavated, which served as a dwelling house, but which also contained workshops. The ground plan is irregular, but it is centered around an atrium tetrastylon, after Vitruvio's definition, a square room covered by a roof on 4 rafters, supported by pillars, and with a square opening in the roof that let rainwater and light come into the courtyard. Those findings shed a much clearer light on the excavation of the settlement of Marzabotto in northern Etruria, which was carried out from the end of the 19th century. The excavations still undertaken. Marzabotto was founded as a small colony towards the end of the 6th century and systematically enlarged in the course of the 5th. What is left are fragments of the fortification and the door supposed, wait a moment, here in this region, and here, eastern part. You must imagine like this. and outside the town, two necropolises, north and east. And in yellow, necropolis, no, green. From here it's green, I don't know. this one, outside the city. There was several cult buildings and a fountain sanctuary in the northern part here. Inside the settlement, a temple for the town god Tinia, Jupiter, is recently discovered and excavated and is situated next to the marketplace. You see, not yet sure because this part is not yet excavated. Workshops have been documented at several locations given in blue. To this day, Mazzabotto is the most thoroughly explored Etruscan settlement. Without any doubt, the rectangular street network was laid out after Greek examples, but it shows Etruscan elements as well, for instance, the strict orientation of the streets towards the quarters of the heavens. For our context, it is interesting to observe that the houses do not stand by themselves, isolated, as in the previous examples, but are integrated into this street system, and one asks oneself whether the courtyard as a center of the house didn't develop out of the necessity to bring light into the house from outside. Lighting from outside had become difficult since the houses stood too close together. Especially here you can see it. The three houses shown here have in common that in the central part the rooms are laid out crosswise, an arrangement which generates the typical element of an atrium, namely tablinum, ale, and the courtyard proper. Tablinum, atrium, and the courtyard. Ale, this one, and the courtyard. The latter is so large, the courtyard, that it was certainly not completely covered, but had an opening in the central part of the roof. In this way, the house was sufficiently lightened, you see the reconstruction above, and rainwater could be collected. It is surely not by chance that Vitruvius has called this kind of roof Atrium Tuscanicum. It goes back to at least to the 5th, probably even to the 6th century BC. Let me further illustrate some findings of Mazzabotto by this reconstruction of an inward sloping roof and of a well and in a setting called in Latin putial. Lately, findings in Rome have also contributed to the discussion about the old Italic atrium house. East of the Roman Forum Romanum, where ancient sources put the nobles, prince, and patrician houses of the royal time and the Republic, a team under the direction of the Italian archaeologist Andrea Carandini have come upon the remains of 5 houses, the earlier building phase of which is dated to the Archaic period around 500 BC. They were reconstructed as atrium houses, you see on the right, very similar to the Mazzabotto ones, but dated about 2 generations earlier. Carandini's reconstruction met with much criticism. That is understandable when you compare the scarcely preserved war remains from the archaic times to the left, and the reconstruction to the right. I have to add, there is a second phase of 4th century. In the core of the reconstructed court, hardly anything had survived. At any rate, the courtyard must have been huge, including an installation to collect rainwater, not mentioned so much in the criticism discussions here. The by far largest we know from Rome in this period. Because underneath the courtyard there lies this monumental cistern dated to the archaic period, that means to the first phase of the house. In so far, I feel justified to take the new house remains from Rome into consideration when discussing the development of the Atrium House, especially as a date of about 530, as I mentioned, fits well with the information gained from the findings at Roselle, mid-6th century house, and of the tomb of the Tablinum in Cervetri from the mid-6th century too. Carandini uses a model to let us imagine the reconstructed atrium of one of his archaic houses in Rome. They were patrician houses, as I mentioned before. With nearly 20 to 40 meters, the measurements of the ground plan are enormous, much larger than what we know from the Greek world of this period. Leaving aside the details of the reconstruction, in any case, the houses and their luxury reflect the self-confidence of the inhabitants. The houses are the predecessors of the town palaces we know from Pompeii's Hellenistic epoch, the most famous is the Casa del Fauno. We expect to find similar buildings one day in Etruria's big cities, such as Cerveteri, Tarquinia, or Vulci, but we lack the respective excavations. Till now, the interest of the archaeologists are concentrated in sanctuaries and in tombs, as you have seen, and in small villages, but not in the large one. When you look at the model, you notice that the roof is reconstructed at Displuviatum Tuscanicum, Atrium Tuscanicum, and without columns, and that the furnishings are taken from the interior of archaic Etruscan tombs. Among them, you discover a seat of the type standing on the center of the house, of the curved type, this one, here, in the axis of the character, between the tablinum and the atrium, and oriented in the direction of the entrance of the domus. This position is not given by chance. It is inspired by some important information we find in ancient literature. One is a story of 390 BC, given by Livy, when the Gauls conquered the city of Rome and entered the patrician houses. The entrances stood open, but the Gauls hesitated to step inside because beings, as he writes, were thronging in the vestibules. Livy tells us that those beings, I'm citing Livy now, besides that their ornaments and apparel were more splendid than belonged to men, seemed also in their majesty and countenance and in the gravity of their expression most like to gods. These beings were the old patricians who didn't want to leave their houses and then were killed by the entering Gauls. From other literary sources, we can learn that in the Roman Republic house of the nobiles, the patron received his clients in the morning for the salutio and for the discussion of the daily affairs. On this occasion, the patron was sitting in the so-called solium, a seat or throne with curved back. That is exactly the furniture we find in the archaic Etruscan tombs. The tradition mentions a number of 500 persons assembled in the atrium of such a patrician domus in Republic time. This enormous number of participants seemed to be by far exaggerated for modern scholars. But you see, the new discovered patrician houses induce us to reconsider this skepticism. Another literary source mentions that the tablinum of the Roman house originally served as a sleeping room because there was a place where the lectus genialis stood. This tradition, together with the position of the solium in the center between tablinum and atrium, here indicated, in theory at least, this tradition, together with the position of the solium in the center between tablinum and atrium, shows a remarkable concordance with the situation we have found in the archaic Etruscan tombs, such as the tomb of the seats and the shields. However, we find a little but maybe significant difference. In the Etruscan tombs, and it's not only this one, there are several of this type, there are two seats of the solium type, one for the paterfamilias and one for the materfamilias, as I mentioned just. This observation leads me to the following questions. Is it allowed to conclude that in the atrium of the aristocratic Etruscan house, in contrast to the Roman practice, there stood also a throne or seat for the wife of the patron? Here indicated with S in this example of Etruria. And further, would this difference mean another contribution to the discussion about the different and more important social position of the Etruscan wife in contrast to the Roman custom? I remember in the book that you cited by Sibylla Haynes, this aspect of the important social position of the Etruscan wife is very well discussed. Those considerations have taken us back to the beginning, to George Dennis and his remarkable discussion about the meaning of the seats in the Etruscan tombs. Do they indeed reflect an element of the Etruscan dwelling house? I think it very probable that the Roman custom of the patres sitting in the atrium continues a tradition that harks back to archaic times and most probably to Etruria. Seats for the deceased are known in Etruria since the 7th century. Grave gifts made of wood or metal, chairs or thrones with a curved back, as in the case of the tomb of the shields and seats. Remarkable examples dating of the early 7th century are the curved pieces of furniture in the anteroom of the tomb of the statues in Ceri near Cevitri, but in ancient time belonged to Cevitri. The tomb is meant to accommodate two persons, and in the anteroom there are two seated figures, almost life-size. They sit opposite from each other and put their feet on a footstool. The interpretation of the figures is controversial, not least because of their bad state of preservation. They consider they are chiseled of the living root in the 7th century, early 7th century BC, and has survived this enormous span of time. And they were discovered by chance 30 years ago almost. Not excavated, at least. Very strange. It was used for animals. They were first published by Giovanni Colonna, who saw both figures as male ancestors. But only one of the statues is definitely male. It has a full beard and holds a scepter in the right hand. The other figure is not bearded and a little smaller, and it's placed on a higher base. You see? And holds in the right hand, a badly eroded attribute of which only a kind of stem and a rounded part are preserved. Presumably, it was a blossom or a flower. Certainly no scepter or liptus, as we'd expect to find on a man. We can obviously looking at a couple, and as they will become common in the 6th century chamber tombs. both persons are shown sitting on a throne in a representative attitude. A finding in the Tomb of the Five Seeds in Cheviteri, the right side, has remained singular to this day, also the other tomb. A cult room in miniature. In a side room, five small seeds are carved out of the tufa, next to each other. They were occupied by clay figurines painted in color, about 50 centimeters high, three men and two women. Three were completely preserved or could be reconstructed. I show you the one from the Capitolinum Museum in Rome. Two more are on exhibit in the British Museum. The room in miniature was originally furnished like a doll's house, as is testified by the remains from the tomb and by the descriptions and drawings of the first documentation in the 19th century. A model in Tübingen shows the original state. There were two tables in front of the five seats. Oh, you see very well. The five seated figures. In the opposite corners, a libation altar, typical form with three parts for libation. And a basket had been carved out of the living rock. And at the wall opposite the entrance, two seats of the curved type were put on a base. Obviously, the two seats were empty, as in the Tomb of the Shields and Seeds. As the tomb was meant to hold only two burials, the relation between the empty seats and the burials is evident. The burials are in the main chamber. This is the lateral chamber. The five persons in front of the tables must be seen as dining, as may also be concluded from other representations. Among the earliest such representations is an urn, almost contemporaneous, also set in the 7th century, from Monte Scudaio. Here the deceased is sitting on the lid of his proper urn in front of an opulent table and eating the funeral repast. Sometimes it's like McDonald's here. In the Tomb of the Five Seeds, the two deceased persons are symbolically joining the funeral past. But who are the other five? They are either deceased or descendants. There is no hint that a living person was ever represented in Etruria. Later grave images argue for the five to be ancestors. I should like to make use of a later example, 4th century, in order to elucidate this aspect. In the tomb of the Lanius family in Oviedo, the noble deceased named Lars Lanius. Here's the inscription. Enters the tomb on a biga guided by a winged demon, a female demon, and with musical accompaniment. The tomb must be seen as a house in the hereafter, with the ancestors who are reclining on clinae, turning to the newcomer and welcome him. Their names are inscribed besides them, and also their deeds. Therefore, the family contact is clear. We realize not only that there exists an immediate link between tomb and dwelling house, but also that the hereafter appears in the shape of a house, so that all three spheres, life, death, and the hereafter, are penetrating each other. It becomes also evident, and that will be my last remark on the topic of the empty seats, that George Dennis was in the right track with his various attempts at interpretation. The empty seats in the tomb served manifold functions. First of all, they referred to the main burials of pater and mater familias in the Roman terminology and were of a representative nature in accordance with their place in the atrium of the dwelling house. But at the same time in the tomb, they stood symbolically for the deceased person's participation in the funeral repast. The seat of the curved type, which does not have any parallels outside Etruria, by the way, is also represented on paintings and on terracotta plaques. This one belongs in the this plaque belongs in the context of our subject because it originally served as decoration on the roof of a building that can be interpreted as a kind of palace. The motif of the plaque was well known in Etruria through vases imported from Greece. The assembly of the gods in the Olympus, headed by Zeus, followed by Athena, and the still sitting Hera, his wife, and other divinities living in the Olympus. The Etruscan artist has changed some attributes of the figures. For instance, the seat of the original Hera has now the typical form with curved back. I'm sorry of this place, because here the seat is very bad preserved. Here you find it. Another plaque is much better to be seen. The interpretation of the scene is supported by the motifs on three other plaques that, along with the plaque of the seated figures, were fastened at the entablature of the roof: a horse race, a marriage scene, and a banquet scene, all motifs taken from the aristocratic world. The terracotta plaques belonged once to a monumental building complex in the hinterland of Siena. Since the 1960s, the complex of Murlo Poggio Civitate is being explored by American archaeologists, who have much broadened our view of Etruscans' early period, be it in the field of architecture, of economy, or politics. Here we are interested in the complex as such. Above the remains of separate structures dating to the late 7th century, here marked in brown, these ones, an almost square building with a lateral length of about 60 to 60 meters was erected in the early 6th century. These parts are preserved, all, and only these are not preserved, contrary of what you think perhaps now. It's a little bit strange. In addition to the terracotta reliefs, already mentioned, the roofs were decorated with a great number of terracotta statues, among them a group of males and somewhat smaller females as acroterial figures on the ridge of the large hall in the east wing, here on the right, called Cowboy in the literature. The statues stretch their arms forward and hold attributes, perhaps litui or insignia of their power. It reminds the reconstruction of the comic design, the main taken from this statue, surely. The statues stretch their arms forward and hold attributes, perhaps litui, as insignia of power, of their power, but it is not clear whether they represent gods or priests or angels. I repeat, they were put on the ridge pole of the right part, this part here. Exactly. From an architectural viewpoint, the complex is remarkable for two reasons. First, because of the large courtyard lined with pillars on three sides. Secondly, because of the tripartite arrangement of the rooms in the pillar three northwest wing. This one. Here is certainly the core of the complex, which is also emphasized by a large vault in rectangle towards which the central room opens it up. Almost at the same time that the excavation at Molo were underway, Swedish archaeologists excavated in Aquarossa near Viterbo the foundations of another big complex, namely the central building of an Etruscan settlement of the late 7th and the 6th centuries. The mid-6th century complex had predecessors of which only few traces have survived, given here in blue and red. Different from Murlo, the complex had only two wings, the function of which is, however, better understood. The north wing, here on the left, this one, is interpreted as a temple, not least because of the roof decoration with figural terracotta plaques. The tripartite structure with pillars in front would also fit this view. Before the central room, there is a rectangle sunk in the ground. This feature reminds one of the central area of the Molo complex, seen before. Could that part have been a sanctuary as well? The east wing, this one of Molo, the east wing is also provided with a portico, and in central position, a tripartite arrangement of the rooms. A bench running along the walls let the room at the right look like a banquet hall. And what would be the general interpretation of the complex in Aquarossa? Again, the terracotta plaques of the roof render information. Their motifs are borrowed from the aristocratic world. There are banquet scenes and the warrior's departure for the fight, combined with deeds of Heracles, that is, the fight with the Nemean lion, or with the Cretan bull, in this case here. So here are the attributes of Heracles. Heracles, the only human associate with the gods. Thus, the Aquarossa complex, the same ideology we find in Athens at this period. A connection Heracles with aristocracy. Thus, the Aquarossa complex, situated in the center of the settlement, should be seen as a residence of the local ruler and as sanctuary. Situated far away from any settlement, Molo, however, could rather have served as a meeting place for several aristocrats, maybe of several towns. But the question must be remain open. In the meantime, the number of these buildings has grown. Scholars call them palaces or residences, and especially regiae. The latter designation is grounded on the fact that the regia in Rome served not only as a resident of the king until the fall of the monarchy in the late 6th century, but also as a sanctuary. We owe it to the American archaeologist Frank Brown that the development of the ground plan of this early Roman building was determined, which joins the Forum Romanum at the east. Here I show you a new synopsis of buildings from Etruria and Latium, arranged in chronological order. You see the dates on the left. that have been called regiae. They are characterized by their size, their mixed nature as dwelling or as residence and sanctuary, the use of roof decoration with equatorial figures and terracotta plaques, which is also the case at the regia in Rome. Another criterion is a date. These buildings first appear in the late 7th century and were forcefully destroyed around 500 BC. With the exception of the Regia in Rome, now, after 500, serving as the office of the Rex Sacrorum and not more the Rex. In the royal period, the Roman Regia was several times remodeled. You see the different phases of Frank Brown here. So this last one, surviving. Oh no, also the. Wait a moment. No, that's the last one which continued. In the royal period, the Roman Regia was several times remodeled. Compared to Molo, number 2, and Aqua Rossa, number 5, and there's another complex I do not mention in Cervitri, you see the main measurements and also the main orientation. These questions I haven't discussed today, that's too much, the orientation of the buildings. And Aqua Rossa, its dimensions were modest. You see the Regia is very small, this one of Rome. Due to the topographical situation, the ground plan was irregular. As a rule, it comprised 3 rooms with a portico in front and a courtyard with an altar, especially in the last phases. Altar. As building type, it was definitely related to the tripartite structures at their center of the Morlo and Aqua Rossa complexes. We must bear in mind that until a few decades ago, those palace-like but at the same time sacred buildings were completely unknown, with the exception of the Regia in Rome and of the mythical description of a so-called Regia of King Latinus mentioned by Virgil. The question of their origins remains unanswered, because neither in the Near East, nor in Phoenicia, nor in Greece, we do find such palaces in its time. I remember in the Ashmolean Museum exposition now, the palace of Philip is more than 2 centuries younger, later. There may be one exception, the so-called building F of the Athenian Agora. All the other examples are central Italy, whose ground plan is surprisingly similar to that of phase 5 of the Regia in Rome. Formerly, the building in essence was seen as a sanctuary. Meanwhile, there exists also the hypothesis that it might be the dwelling house or the residence of the Pisistratids. If the hypothesis holds true, that would mean agreement in form and content with the situation in Rome. Just as all such regia in Etruria, building F in essence was also destroyed around 500 BC and then rebuilt. In essence, as well as in Rome, this is a time of the fall of the monarchy. For Etruria, we may suppose similar revolutionary changes in politics and society. With the consideration, 3 there agrees the fact that the monumental building of Morlo was not simply destroyed around 500, but was carefully dismantled and sealed by a deposit of soil. Obviously, all memory should be extinguished. There are still surprises in store for archaeologists, as I should like to demonstrate finishing my talk, with the first results and theories about recent excavations in Gabii. In archaic times, Gabii was an important, independent Latin settlement to the east of Rome. The aerial photo shows the general situation of the settlement and the former lake. And also numerous archaeological activities within the outside the settlement. Right now, important Italian excavations are underway on the Acropolis. Here. These structures that are being exposed here are closely followed by the Italian press, but are not yet published. For us, there remains a look at a photo found in the internet showing a former state of the excavation. We see the foundations of a building with three rooms, this one, lying side by side. A portico in front is not yet visible on this picture. Here it is, well preserved. And you may recognize the walls are like this, almost a meter high. The basic shape is that of the architecture of Etruscan tombs and houses from the 6th century. The Gabi building is put in the same time frame. At a right angle to the building, traces of a predecessor from the late or 7th century have in the meantime been laid open, an oval structure with two supports in the interior. At last, wait a moment. If I remember well, it was here. And now excavate in the meantime. I repeat, 8th, 7th century, and an oval structure with two supports in the interior. We have encountered the shape at the beginning of my talk in Etruscan tombs and houses of 8th and 7th century, the same date, and the two main house types of the early archaic periods. The Gabii findings are also important because of their central location on the Acropolis and because of a terracotta plaque, maybe there are several in the meantime, showing the figure of Minotaurus from Greek mythology, the same motif that was part of the decoration of the Regia in Rome. Insofar, the late archaic building at Gabii is seen as a regia by the excavator, as the residence of a local ruler. Livy tells us that after the expulsion of Tarquinius Priscus from Rome, his son Sextus Tarquinius took power in Gabii, but later on was killed by the inhabitants, almost 500. The Italian excavators presume that the last descendant of the Tarquinii took possession of this building on the Acropolis. It is noteworthy, at any rate, that this building too was destroyed about 500 and was even sealed by an artificial deposit of soil in the manner that we have seen in the monument complex in Molo. For a final estimate, we must wait for further the results from the ongoing excavations in Gabii. But it is obvious that archaeology, and in particular the research of houses, can make important contributions in view of the incisive events around 500 BC that influence the history, politics, and society, not only in Italy, but also in other cultures of the Mediterranean, like in Greece. Gabii is a new stone in this mosaic, but I'm convinced not the last one. Thank you very much for your attention.